Members here, but I'm going to step members through documents. Well, no, I'm not, because there's not enough of us here. But we've been informed that Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner, who was began the presentations yesterday, has succumbed to the flu. So he is not able to join us this morning, and we all send our best, I'm sure. But we have excellent staff here with Alex Bartolik, Bob Held, and Gene Wood, who provide tremendous support to members. These are really good people to know, and so they'll do a fantastic job of stepping us through the balance of the continuing care items that are before us. And in members' packets, maybe we can start. You know, I'm not going to be able to do this without stepping people through what we have. So yesterday we had the MMB. So when your neighbors show up, maybe you can help them get oriented. Yesterday we had the MMB documents that were the white, more brief statements per line item, and the DHS yellow documents, and the 10-page budget overview. All of those materials are now in a budget book. That is there for all members. We did also for Senator Carlson, and I know everybody will be interested in the acronyms page is in the front page of the book. And then I got chided over and over and over again yesterday about saying that it wasn't that complicated to get to the federal poverty levels. You know, I stand corrected. The chart is in the book. It's the first page of the book. So people can use that, but I'm sure there's a few people whose brains are malformed like mine and actually did follow how to do that. Then we go into the Department of Human Services, and again, all of the documents that we had yesterday, there's tabs to guide you through portions of Human Services. There's the 10-page Governor's Budget Proposal Tracking Document, and then the DHS Initiatives Fast Facts that was the yellow sheet. It's just a duplicate of it. Members can then take the yellow sheets with them and the other ones that are in your folders and kind of leave your budget books here is probably the best practice. And then we put a tab for the MMB sheets that we were working off of yesterday with the cross tabs to the Fast Facts documents. That's the next bunch. And then there's another tab in there for a little bit of additional information that is available on MMB's website per budget area in DHS. And members can peruse those at their, at their discretion. One of the things that I will note in this is that it is, 180-some pages, and there are not page numbers on this document. It makes it difficult to try to help members. We did stick a little packet of tabs, so as you work through it, and if there's particular items that you want to be able to get back to, stick a tab in it and write something on it. We're all working, trying to make sure everybody has everything that everybody has. Then we'd go on to the Department of Health. It'll be a very similar sheets off of the MMB websites, the health boards, each of the health boards, also off of the MMB website. And then the last tab, other, is really the health insurance exchange sheets that are available on the MMB website. So that's really a compilation of the best information that we have. You can still, today, if you're trying to compare two documents, you do have the Fast Facts and the MMB and pages and the governor's tracking, fiscal tracking sheet that you can set next to things. So, I hope that gives everybody a little bit of a intro into what's available here and how we're going to step through it. Starting on page 12 of the, remember, continuing care was working through the MMB sheets and the one numbered 12 that cross-references to Fast Facts 17 on the Reform 2020 initiatives is where we left off with the Continuing Care Administration. So, hopefully people are are tracking a little bit. And with that, I would turn it over to Alex and Jean and Bob. And thank you for coming. As you provide the details on your items, please state your name for the record. And welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alex Bartolik, and I am the Director of Disability Services with the Continuing Care Administration. It's going to take three of us to fill in for Lauren Coleman here, but we will do our best. We're going to start with transition initiatives for certain populations, and actually this one is going to be addressed by Ann Berry. There are three components.
Already? Senator, Senator Kiffmeyer.
I know, Senator. So, I do have to tell you, though, Representative Huntley and Thiessen, we're okay with it. So just in case it bothers you.
We'll work with you, Senator.
Okay. One of the questions I have is, where are we at now that we have these books? Where are we at on handouts so I can be with you on your pages?
Yeah. That's the MMB sheets that were the smaller set, the white set. It is... So the Department of Human Services, the first tab. I don't know. Are the colors? You know, if you go to the second of the less formal tabs, you'll find the beginning of the MMB sheets that have the little FF2 handwritten off to the side. That's the cross reference to the fast facts. If you go to the page 12 on that document. And again, there is a copy of these from yesterday in members' packets still, and you can take those with you or leave them in your save folder. But the budget books really should remain here. I can tell you right now, we all worked very hard to put these together, and we're not excited at the prospect of needing to put another one together for a member who walks off with it and loses it. It's happened before, but it would be very frowned upon by staff. So leave the budget books here and take the copies with you if you need to. So there are two copies. But with that, Senator Kiffmeyer, are you with us? Page 12, the first item that cross-references to the fast facts, page 17, Reform 2020, initiative, intensive services for children with autism spectrum disorder, correct?
Mr. Chair, because Lauren covered that yesterday, I was going to move on unless you wanted to handle questions
okay,
on that.
Okay, not questions yet. We were going to step through them. My mistake. Which one are we? We're on page 12 there, correct?
Page 12, it's the transition initiatives
for
certain populations that,
there we go.
That corresponds to...
Fast Facts 45.
Yes.
There we go.
And that one, actually, I'm not going to address. again, this is a compilation of several different initiatives, and Ann Berry will talk about all of them together when she does her presentation and walkthrough. So we're going to move right on to Bob Held, who will talk about the nursing facility.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Held from the Department of Human Services, the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. I'm going to start with the item that's labeled Nursing Facility Rate Increase and Quality Add-on, and it has FF19 next to it. So on page 19, you'll see a little bit more background on this proposal as well. What this is two rate increases that would apply to nursing facilities in the Medicaid program. The first one is an across-the-board rate increase in an equal percentage of their operating payment rate, and an equal amount of money is also dedicated in this proposal to a quality add-on, which would be available to most nursing homes in varying amounts depending on their total quality score. There would be a small number of nursing homes, about a dozen, that would get a zero increase, and the facility or facilities with the very highest quality would get up to about 2.1% increase on this.
That's on the quality side.
Based on their quality.
And then about half of this money is for the just base, and about half is on the quality? That isn't clear in the documents that
But that's correct,
that
Mr.
we have
Chair.
Before us.
Yeah.
That's one of the questions I had.
The money is split half and half.
Okay.
And moving on then, the next proposal on the top of page 13 is suspend APS operating, and the one following that is to suspend APS property rate inflation adjustments for nursing facilities. And those are in the APS law. APS stands for the Alternative Payment System, which is goes back over 15 years and has an automatic inflation feature in it. However, the automatic inflation has been suspended every year since 1999, allowing the legislature to do something else in its place, either distribute it differently or make a larger amount of money available, or in fact, in the recent years, to actually freeze rates so that there was a 0% adjustment. This is being suspended again, and in this case, both operating and property are proposed to be suspended. Property has only been suspended for, I believe, 2 years, in the most recent 2 years, and this is the money that is then being used to fund the rate increase and the quality add-on in the prior proposal.
That partially fund. It looks like the base increase and the quality add-on is quite a bit. The two together.
These two amounts, if you look at the first year, it comes to about $5.3 million.
Yep.
And that's how much is being spent on the other.
Okay.
All right. The next item on here is the Home and Community-Based Services Pay for Performance Initiative. Did you have?
No, I was asking you.
And this is going to pick up on some of the strategies that have been successful with nursing facilities around home and community-based services and allowing them to compete through a process to be receiving some funding for quality projects to be able to improve quality in home and community-based services and later build to a pay-for-performance activity. We need to be collecting information from people who use services as well as other indicators of quality. And so this proposal both helps us fund the infrastructure and developing the consumer surveys and other information to build the indicators for quality and then allow our home and community-based providers to both participate in a project where they can improve their own quality, they can design what they want to do and achieve outcomes, and later pay for performance that will be an add-on to their rates based on achieving certain quality indicators. The next item on the top of page 14 talks about waiver management improvements. Our disability waiver programs, which include the developmental disabilities waiver, the waiver for people with brain injury, people who have physical disabilities, mental illness, and also people who are at hospital level of care, are managed at a county level on an aggregate average, meaning that there's flexibility in providing support to meet people's needs and to vary that over time. These are often lifelong services, and they will have to change over time as to the type of services and the amount of support. We would like to make some changes in how we manage those dollars to increase our efficiency and our ability to continue to serve more people. We do have counties have aggregate averages. They have a certain amount of money they can hold in reserve to manage unexpected needs. But what we have seen over time is a trend where some counties have a higher reserve than others, and we have other counties who can't serve individuals. So based on criteria that we would develop so that counties do have the ability to hold reserves to serve people with unexpected needs that they're responsible for, we also want to be able to manage the money in order to move it to another county if they're unable to serve someone in order to increase statewide access. With this proposal, we also want to be able to focus on some different ways of doing business and helping support counties and providers in learning about other ways that might be more cost-effective to deliver services, and then also having a provision that would require people to use state plan services first before they go on to a waiver. It's inherent in the waiver program, but we want to strengthen that, particularly with our reform activities. We think we will have more robust state plan services, and we want to reserve the waivers for those people who have needs who cannot otherwise be met.
Senator Rosen had a question on this item.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, the $173,000, is that going to be used to equalize the counties, or is that just for just the department to be in use? Because as it says the department to move the funds. So is that just for
I had
administration?
I had the same question. What is the money needed mm-hmm. for there?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, the money is for department resources in order to be able to work with counties to manage the dollars differently, to be able to help them do forecasting. We don't want to move dollars if somebody really needs it and we just don't know about it. And then also to provide training and technical assistance as people are looking at new options. We are trying to maximize the current dollars available for the services.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Is this going to have potentially a stronger impact on rural counties than it would on metro counties?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, not necessarily. We actually have a safety net where we can help smaller rural counties, so we are more likely to be able to assist them. And the variation of who holds a reserve varies across time, but I think it's going to not necessarily hit one group of counties more than another.
Thank you.
We do have a report, an online report, that has shown for 2012 as an example, what's the difference in spending from what's been allowable by counties, so that there is some information if you wanted to check on certain counties and see what their reserve has been over time to look at some of the trends.
Thank you.
Could we just get that
Senator.
Sent to us? Sometimes finding those things on your websites is easier for you than us.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, we will get the links to you and get you copies of the reports if you would like.
Okay, thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The next item is a quality initiative around positive practices and behavioral safeguards and supports. And this is looking at how can we adopt best practices in supporting people who might otherwise have challenging behaviors that people have difficulty in responding to. We have had situations where people have used restraint or seclusion, and sometimes excessively, because they haven't known what else to do. We want to promote practices that support people, that use trauma-informed care, that are able to allow people to live successfully in the community and reduce use of restraint and any seclusion. And so this particular item builds on training for providers as well as for those who are doing assessments and planning for services. It also develops a small team of two people to be able to monitor any emergency use of restraints and seclusions across our home and community-based services, so we understand where there are potential issues and where we might need to support providers so that they're better able to support all people. And this is an important step in reducing crisis services, use of more restrictive institutional settings, which are often expensive, by really supporting our community providers. The next item around equality initiative is about our waiver standards, phase two. We have been working on waiver standards for some time. You have seen previous legislation on this. Not only do we want to have a set of standards across all of our home and community-based service programs and all five waivers. This includes services that are regulated by the Department of Human Services. It covers services that are in our elderly waiver, as well as our developmental disabilities, brain injury, the community alternatives for disabled individuals, and community alternatives for people who are at risk of hospital level of care. So we want one set of standards which will help increase provider capacity. We also want the ability to reward providers and have certifications for people who specialize so that we understand what they are. We will be bringing forward language with the new set of standards that we have developed with stakeholders and that will be the licensing for those services.
One thing you call this waiver provider standards phase two. Maybe you could remind members what phase one was and where
Mr.
we're
Chair,
at.
Mr. Yeah. Chair, first in 2009, there was legislation authorizing us to develop these new standards. In part, we have to do this because we are in a corrective action plan with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, who have said they will not allow federal participation unless we make some changes in our program. We came back last year with some standards, and some of those standards for certain services that have previously not been licensed were adopted. But this next phase is applying a more consistent set of standards across those services that have been licensed before, but using one set of standards instead of multiple standards.
Mr.
Senator
Chair?
Plossen.
Thank you. Would this affect personal care attendants?
Mr. Chair and Senator Claussen, no, this does not affect personal care attendants. There is a report that will be coming to the legislature in response to a request last year to study the appropriateness of licensing personal care attendants, and there may be part of these standards that could be applicable, but that this is around our waiver services, our home and community-based services.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. In regards to this, I notice on the FAST fact sheet on the bottom it says fee component is budget neutral. So even though this shows up, is there also another place where we'll see is this what you expect to take in fees? Is that the dollar amount? And is this a special
Senator
revenue?
Absolutely. The fees would come with the, you know, with the fiscal note that we would see before it comes back to this committee, absolutely. And it'll have, you know, the fees collected, you know, the average number and what the fee is and netted out, and it'll be done in a manner to be fiscally neutral. Yeah, and we will see all that when the proposal actually comes forward.
And Mr. Chair, another clarification on that there will be a separate bill discussing the fee. This is about the standards.
Got it. Thanks. Sorry about that, Mr. Chair. Bob Hild again. I'm going to describe the next two proposals on the top of page 15. The one labeled Enhance Audit Activity Resources for Nursing Facilities adds one audit position to the division, which will allow us to or enable us to audit a number of areas where we think that there could be savings to the Medicaid, to the state share of Medicaid, that would be well in excess of the costs of the position. And the next one is to restore the plan closure adjustment authority. This is a program that was first enacted in 2001, has been in a number of different forms, but basically allows us to approve some closures if they're done on a planful basis and in cooperation with the local social service agency, and to pay an incentive portion of their payment rate to encourage them to close beds that are generally that are not in service or facilities that are not needed.
Senator Brown?
And that will be a savings proposal.
Okay. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Held, is there any plan for facilities who consistently meet or exceed their audit standards to decrease activity for those facilities and focus on those who aren't meeting the requirements?
Mr. Held?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that is somewhat how we already do auditing. The audit activity tends to focus on, looking at specific items that are reported by everybody and determining who the outliers are where it's questionable that the information they're reporting could in fact be correct. And if somebody's cost report tended to be full of errors, we would, you know, if that type of mechanism was finding a lot of errors, then we would be looking more closely at everything that they report. Some facilities probably don't have to provide too much underlying documentation. Others would be providing much more.
Thank you.
Moving on to back to Alex.
Okay. I'm going to be on the bottom of page 15 with the HIV rebate adjustment. And in Minnesota, we do provide assistance for supplemental insurance and medication drug coverage for people living with HIV/AIDS. And this budget item corrects a double appropriation that was made, and it also would return $2.4 million that was expected to come into this account. It will leave it in the general fund. Basically, our rebate account has grown faster than we expected. We've been very efficient at collecting rebates from our pharmaceutical companies as part of our participation in this program, and we are able to provide the supports and services that people need using rebate dollars, and we do not need the repayment of a $2.4 million suspension that was done during some tough budget decisions. Right now, we're able to cover that with our own funding.
Okay.
And that concludes our section. This concludes the section for continuing care.
Did we do the Reform 2020 on the next page, the housing stability? That's not yours.
Right. Reform 2020 includes a number of items from different parts of the department. Yeah. So while it's part of Reform 2020, another area will be speaking to it.
Okay. Well, questions of members then. In terms of watching the clock, you know, we did ask Assistant Commissioner Lights to return today. He's only able to join us from 9:30 to 10, so we're going to try to make sure that by 9:30 we're done with continuing care and able to accommodate Assistant Commissioner Lights. And with that, somebody had a question. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question about the nursing facility rate increase and the quality add-ons. One of the problems that a lot of nursing homes have, obviously, with improving quality is with a lack of funding. So I was wondering, you know, I noticed that it says here that, you know, that the facilities will be rewarded for making investments across five quality measures. And obviously, if a facility doesn't have the funding necessary to make those investments, I'm just wondering if it's going to be those facilities that are already doing best that are going to be getting the rewards, and those that are struggling the most won't because they don't have the funding necessary to make such investments. I'm just wondering if you could address that.
Mr. Held, and then also maybe some insight into what the five quality measures actually are would help as well. Mr. Held?
Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, the curious thing about the relationship between the amount of money we pay facilities and the quality of the services that they deliver is that there's virtually no relationship between them. If you were to take and create a scattergram, which would be a graph showing rates and quality, and put a dot for each facility, it would look like somebody sneezed on the computer screen. We've done this analysis numerous times. We've done it for all facilities. We've done it by geographic area. The most recent analysis we did, we finally, for the first time, got a statistically significant relationship with a correlation of approximately 0.1, which means it might be statistically significant, but it's extremely weak. I continue to assert that oddly and curiously and contrary to sort of your intuition and mine as well, there is not a strong relationship between the two. So what that means is that we have very high quality facilities with very low rates, and we have very low quality facilities with high rates, as well as the other two quadrants. They're all populated roughly equally. The quality measures that are used for this come out of our report card. We began publishing a report card in January of 2006. Just a couple months ago, it moved from the Health Department's website to the Department of Human Services website when we completely rewrote the report card. So we have a whole new report card. There's seven quality measures in the report card. We use five of those quality measures for purposes of determining a total quality score. The quality measures that are used for the quality score include the resident's quality of life, which comes from interviews with residents that are conducted face-to-face. Last year, we did face-to-face interviews in every nursing home in the Medicaid program with a total of 13,000 residents. And in that interview, the resident has the opportunity to speak for themselves in private and understanding, hopefully, that what they're sharing is confidential. We will not go back to the nursing home, you know, all that kind of stuff. The second quality measure has to do with clinical quality. It comes off of the annual and quarterly assessment that the feds require that nursing homes complete. It's called the MDS, the minimum data set. And the word minimum might be part of the title, but if you look at it, it's not very minimal. It's a pretty extensive assessment of exactly what the characteristics and needs and strengths of an individual are. And when you look at that data from quarter to quarter and detect changes in a person's condition and consider how those changes compare to the norms of change among the whole population, you can detect signs that indicate whether there's high or low quality. And so that's what the quality indicators measure is all about. In addition, the Minnesota Department of Health conducts a very thorough inspection of each nursing home on approximately an annual basis. That data is run through an algorithm which gives them a score on the inspection findings, which basically looks at, are people being harmed or not? So it's kind of a we often hear people say the inspection doesn't measure quality, but when facilities get an inspection with zero deficiencies, they seem to think it does measure quality because they're very public about that and very proud of it, rightfully so. I personally think it does measure quality, often from a input and process perspective, but more so now than in past years on an outcome basis as well. We also look at staff retention of the employees there on the first day of a reporting period. What proportion are still there in among just direct care workers on the last day of the reporting period? We actually run about 72% retention rate statewide and have been running between 70 and 72 for as long as we've taken this measure. We also look at pool staff, the use of temporary staff from an outside agency. Used to be a big problem. Today, in fact, very few facilities use pool staff, probably about a third of all facilities, and in much lower numbers than what we saw in the past. In addition, we look at what portion of the beds are in single bedrooms and what is the direct care staffing level. Those two measures are not part of the total quality score, but the first five that I mentioned are. Did that answer the question?
I think that got started. It might, you know, I mean, I think there might be additional questions and teasing it out. So this was based off of the report card that was in place since 2006, you said?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And so in what manner is that information public? I mean, facilities across the state know where they fall. Typically, this won't be a surprise to them. It's something that they've become accustomed to. I mean, certainly some of them probably have issues with it, but it won't be a surprise where they fall. It's not a new system that we're implementing.
It's not new, though some of the data that we're now making available to the public is new. So what the research has shown us is that if you measure quality of a healthcare provider, that can just measuring it can have an effect and cause people to want to do better. If you disclose your measurement of the quality to the provider, that's kind of essential to having that effect. Generally, providers will think we're really good. You know, we're doing a great job on these on our care. We provide the best care, and rightfully they should think that. However, when they have actual data compiled across the entire state, every nursing home, in a very objective manner, the self-reported data is audited, then they suddenly look at it and they find, you know, in there's certain areas, and almost every provider will find this. There's certain areas where we're doing well, and other areas where we could stand to work on some improvement. And even in areas where our entire state is doing well relative to the nation, you see that there's room for improvement. We've had huge improvement on things like falls, prevention, and so forth. So you make that data available to the provider, that activity has an effect on quality. But then, when you make it available to the public, that ups the ante quite a bit and has a much bigger effect on quality. And you can see that in the quality data trends for the state, back to when we started publishing the report card. So the report card, to get to your initial question, is published online. It's on the DHS website. Because it's a new domain, I might get a little mixed up, but it's nhreportcard is one word, .mn.gov, I believe, is the web address for the report card. We get about 2,000 people that use it every month.
Senator Eakin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Held, yeah, I'm glad you're doing this tracking, and it sounds like for several years now. So we've got some information, going back to compare not just nursing home facilities with other nursing home facilities, but from year to year whether we're generally making progress. And I know there's a number of different areas that you're measuring here. But it would be helpful, too, to see as a state how we're doing as far as making progress from year to year in these different quality measurements. So, and I don't know if you can speak to that now, but certainly information in the future would be helpful to know whether the general quality of care is improving across the state from year to year.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, we'd be happy to come back and brief or send information to you on that.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson and then Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Held, bear with me as being a bit of a newbie on this, but it seems like you spent a lot of time here telling us that there is no direct correlation between cost and quality, and that with a scattergram you do find there's a lack of mathematical correlation. It seems to me that if you're rewarding the dots that do have the high quality, that you're actually going to create a correlation, and which would be an artificial correlation between cost and quality. Is that what I'm seeing here? Is that we're – and it kind of goes on to Senator Eakin's comment about those that don't have the funds to invest in more quality will be actually at a disadvantage to improve their quality. Is that what we're reaching here, is an artificially created graph that will show a correlation?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, your question, frankly, throws me for a bit of a loop. It's a very intriguing way to think about it. There's a number of ways that we could think about how to pay nursing homes in order to, I mean, why do we pay them at all? We pay them so that they can operate and provide the service that we want to buy from them on behalf of people who are eligible for Medicaid. That's the reason why we pay them. So because we pay for 57% of the nursing home days that residents receive in nursing homes in Minnesota, we feel that we need to be thinking about how our role as a purchaser can be leveraged to improve quality. So in thinking about payment systems, we could just simply have a cost-based system. Whatever it costs you to operate, maybe we set some limits. And, in fact, that's what's in law right now. However, it's suspended. In 2011, in 2009 it was suspended. In 2011, language was enacted that said we're not to take any more steps on the phase-in of a cost-based system. We could have a pricing system where we just say, okay, a day in a nursing home, a tube of toothpaste, a car, they're all a commodity, and we should pay the same. I don't care how much it costs you to bring a tube of toothpaste to the counter. I'm going to pay $2 for it. Same thing with a day of nursing home care. I think that would be a bit problematic because I think it would be a huge windfall for some facilities, and it would force some other facilities to go out of business. Or, alternatively, the cost to the state of bringing everybody up to close to the highest level would be enormous. We feel that we have a number of mechanisms that, frankly, tend to be a bit on the punitive side for trying to encourage quality. The inspection process, it finds deficiencies, it results in fines, it can result in monitoring, it can result in a denial of payment for any new admissions, it can result in decertification from the program and from Medicare. So we have that, and we have no choice about doing that because those are federal processes to be part of the state federal Medicaid program. We think that a benefit can be achieved by using the payment system to leverage quality, to reward payment reward through payment to reward higher quality. We currently do have a pay-for-performance mechanism that Alex referred to earlier. We call it the Performance-Based Incentive Payment Program, PIP. And under PIP, we do an annual request for proposals from nursing homes. And we say to them, we've got a certain amount, we've got a pool of money here. And we're going to give, on a competitive basis, it's a completely voluntary program, on a competitive basis, we're going to give nursing homes a rate increase for a limited period of time to undertake a quality improvement project. So a facility that is short on resources and that impedes their ability to pursue a quality improvement project, they can compete for PIP. And over half of the facilities in the state have done that and, in fact, provide higher quality care on clinical care than those who have never participated in a PIP project. So we do have, it's a one-of-a-kind in the country program that is actually a quite robust mechanism for paying for performance in a way that would, address the issue that you're raising. I do feel that the quality add-on is also an effective mechanism. We did it at about this level in 2006. And when you look at the data for 2006, which happened to be the same year that the report card started, so how do you tease the two apart? But there was a real steep climb in quality that occurred at that time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, and Mr. Hill, so you, and may I assume that you also work on sharing of best practices between those outliers, for instance, the ones that have the highest cost and the lowest quality, to improve that low-quality provider with the best practices that might be gleaned from a low-cost, high-quality provider. Can I assume that that's also happening?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, you can be confirmed that that is what's happening. Part of the program is a goal to disseminate what we learn. So as an example, we had a collaborative group that did quite a large project across many facilities on falls reduction. And they had facilities, by my recollection, they had a reduction in falls of up to 90%. So it's profoundly beneficial. And in fact, because those falls are being prevented, it even saves not only quality of life and those kind of things, which is the primary goal, but it saves money for the state as well, because when people fall and get injured, what you're going to see is more costs to the whole healthcare system and to the Medicaid portion for the nursing home, because their case mix will go up. So the dissemination goal is one that we have worked on. We're currently coming up towards the end of a major evaluation, a three-year evaluation of this that was funded by the federal government. And part of what that's looking at is how to better disseminate our findings. Another focus area of this is that we've been able to identify the really poor performing facilities. So, for example, we tried a program where we looked at the one-star facilities. The report card's a five-star system, so the worst score you can get is one star. We looked at the facilities that had one star on quality of life or on quality indicators, and we offered them a free opportunity to participate in a program where we contracted with a consulting outfit to help them with problem identification, root cause analysis, strategy development, and so forth. We did see some pretty significant improvements in the quality of those that chose to participate in that program.
Okay.
So we're constantly looking at how to disseminate, how to bring up the bottom as well as encourage the top.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Held, so there's a
– Senator Carlson.
Would there be a delay between the like you mentioned, a major drop in falls – that would be reported, and so their score would go up, and would they enter into this the ability to do an add-on with them rather quickly, or is this something that there's a major delay before their score is recalculated and they enter into that program?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson. Well, we haven't had a quality add-on for about 6 years now, so it's hard to know how those are going to play out relative to each other, but if a facility did a PIP project, part of the money that they're getting for that is at risk for achieving the goals that we agreed upon at the beginning of the project. So they're going to get some money related to doing the project. Part of that is contingent upon being successful with it. Then that money is taken back off their rate. If we then do the quality add-on and they retain that quality improvement, it should be reflected there too.
So, yeah. Mr. Held, one of the things I saw interesting when I was reading the Fast Facts version, it says that the quality add-on rates for the 13 and 14 rate years will become part of the base rate for those facilities. So I just found that odd. Like, they don't have to continue to show good improvement, and those that are at the bottom and learning to improve are unable to get into this, and it just seems odd in that framing. So maybe you could give us some insights. I mean, I'm certain that there's a good – oh, and let me back up and just say, Senator Carlson, I know you characterize yourself as a newbie, but those of us who have been around a long time have seen Mr. Held answer a lot of really difficult questions about nursing home rates, and I've never heard him say that it threw him for a bit of a loop, a question. So that was impressive.
It must be a sign of aging, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
For all those years you've been listening to me. What was the question now? Oh, in the base.
13 and 14 quality improvements just become part of the base for those that are succeeding in 13 and 14. And it just seems odd for those that are, struggling and trying to improve and then succeeding, they might miss the bus. I don't know, just some insights into why a two-year pay for performance and then that just becomes part of the base.
Mr. Chair, there's a couple lines of thought behind that position. One is that if you put the money on a sort of a revolving account where they get it for that year and then they have to keep re-earning it, that the ability of the provider to then use that money for things like wage increases is somewhat impaired, because they don't, they're not absolutely assured that they're going to still have that money next year. I think some providers probably would say we have the confidence, but others might not be quite so confident. Another line of thought on that is that rates have been frozen for 4 years now, and that because of those rates being frozen, it just ought to be put in the base. That said, we are undertaking a bit of a vigorous debate internally as to the second biennium.
Okay.
Because we are suspending APS for the 4 years, APS inflation, and we are talking about using the money in the first 2 years in the split manner that I described, and we're talking about using all of it for the quality add-on in the second biennium, not splitting it that way.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and nice to see you, Mr. Held. I'm very glad to see the governor's budget has a commitment to the nursing facilities. My question, though, is, and Mr. Held has been working on this quality add-on for a very long time, and the pay for performance, and you've been talking about this for a long time. I'm glad to see that it's having its coming out party, and we're going to be able to move this along. However, I am concerned still about the winners and losers that we've been all talking about, and especially the metro versus rural issue. A nursing long-term care facility is still a business, and the bottom line is for them to be in the black and be able to make payroll ongoing. So there are some factors that I think the rural area still addresses and has more issues with than, per se, the metro. So I would like, and I don't know if we'll have a chance, Mr. Chair, to talk about the critical access nursing results, the bill that we passed last year. It was a pilot project, and if we'll have a chance to talk about that in the future. But I think that's still an area that we need to look at, that we can't treat them all equal throughout the state. We can certainly set these measures, which I truly believe in, because, as I said, competition is good. And we need to make sure that they compete. But if all the factors going into this competition aren't fair, then we are going to create winners and losers. So just for future reference, Mr. Chair, if we could talk about some of the variables throughout the state and what we're doing about it.
I think that's a very good conversation point, and I do hope to have some further conversations about the critical access nursing home demonstration project or pilot mm-hmm. project or whatever it was, and here on another date about the experiences with that and how it worked and implemented. And, you know, I just have to say I've heard from a lot of rural members that if we're going to be putting money into nursing homes in terms of rate add-ons, I mean, we really should take a look at some of these historic disparities that have grown and grown and grown when we're not adding money into the system, and maybe try to do a rebasing instead. If we're looking at investments, and that's something that will need to be part of the discussion. I'm not jumping to the conclusion today, but I do know that will need to be a robust part of the discussion. Looking at the critical access will be a piece of that, and we'll certainly, you know, take the governor's proposal and give it serious consideration. But there's going to be other ideas too as we try to figure out how to make improve the nursing home industry and the care that we provide for seniors around the state. It'll be a conversation that we all have a lot of passion about. So I don't know if you had a response to Senator Rosen, or we have a number of questions still. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I look forward to having that discussion. I was thinking of responding to Senator Rosen by telling her about the Critical Access Nursing Facility Program, but I know she authored it, and I've met with her about it, and I do look forward to having that conversation.
Great. Senator Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excellent discussion, and all the points made are all very well taken. I think about the only thing I would add to it is don't underestimate the power of an incentive. We look at this as a reward, but remember it's a powerful incentive, too, for those who are not in that quality add-on right now, because I think the others will say, well, how can I get that? My only concern is that if it's just 2 years, it's hard for those who are on the lower end of the quality to have the time to get up into, which is pretty what we want to do. But it's a powerful incentive. If you take a look at your Sunday newspaper, there's incentives to go shopping. It's called sales and discounts. And I've seen people spend a Sunday afternoon taking notes and clipping coupons. So it's a powerful one. It's a human dynamic. And don't underestimate that. And many times it works by far better than the punitive. So, and it gets you more willingness to go along with that. So I appreciate that, and I think we can have that kind of discussion, but we definitely need to incentivize people to do better, and that is powerful. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for those comments, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I really have enjoyed this conversation and the interest level. I do think we should look at rebasing. I want to support that, and I am concerned, I share concern that with the no argument about incentives, I do worry about one-time incentives having one-time change. They're not sustained, and I don't know how you can build in along with, if you want to put this in the base, how then do we assure that there is a sustained change and not simply a new change or a loss of the other and then a request for new funding again. So, but my question was, as you take a look at quality throughout the state, some of the issues that have been coming to me in my office are concerns from those who are providing the care in nursing homes. And they're concerned that there is, in law, a requirement that is met, a minimum standard, it seems to me, in terms of the amount of time within a 24-hour period that a client receives direct care. And that direct care is an accumulation of the care that comes from all of the providers in that nursing home. So it can be serving the meal to them. It can be feeding. It can be bathing. It can be massage, or it can be occupational therapy. It's a 2 hours out of 24 hours of direct care requirement, which is this what the standard is going to be. As long as we have 2 hours of care, we've met the requirement. The request is to change that and to increase that number to 4 hours of direct service care. I'm curious to know, in your root cause analysis, as you take a look at quality, is this looked at in terms of how much time is spent directly with the care of clients, and what are you thinking about the impact of changing that in statute?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, you're correct. There is a statute. It's a health department statute requiring 2 hours per resident day of direct care staffing. And it gets into some fair amount of definition about what counts and what doesn't count. In-service director, director of nursing don't count as direct care because they're doing administrative type functions. I wouldn't be prepared to tell you exactly how other specific positions are counted in that. The health department would have to respond to those types of questions. When we had our original case mix system that was implemented in 1985 and then replaced in 2002, under that system we did have an acuity adjusted staffing standard of 0.95 hours per what's called a standardized day. And everybody's day was multiplied by a certain number between 1 for the lowest level of care and 4.12 for the highest level of care. And so that meant the staffing standard for the highest level of care was actually almost 4 hours. It was 3.8 hours. However, facilities didn't staff, generally speaking. There were some that were at 0.95, but most facilities staffed higher than that. And by my recollection, staffing around 1.25 was pretty common. When we moved to the new system, an argument was made that the new system, the RUG system that we use today, RUGs stands for resource utilization groups, that RUGs did not set the weights based so much on time studies and staff levels. And I happen not to have agreed with that and sought to have the staffing standard be transitioned along with the new system. As you can see by this discussion, I lost that fight, and that staffing standard has never been restored. So I am aware that there is some discussion about coming up with a new staffing standard. The research on it is a bit ambiguous as to what the effects are. I believe that the research would tell us that staffing below a certain critical level will lead to problems, and those are the kind of stories that staff will often tell us about. That beyond a certain level, it appears that the most critical staffing component for its relationship to quality is the RN, which, of course, in the nursing home we have the least of, typically, because most direct care staffing is certified nursing assistants. We do look at that on the report card, and on the report card we report the actual hours of direct care. However, we adjust it for acuity so that you have an apples-to-apples comparison across facilities. So if you compare a low acuity facility with a high acuity facility, you've got a number that takes that into account, and you can say this facility truly does staff higher than that facility. And we also wage adjust it, which means that the high wage positions count heavier than the low wage positions, because we didn't want the system to create an incentive to get rid of all the RNs and LPNs and have just brand new nursing assistants get a lot of hours, but they don't have any supervision or nurses to provide guidance and assessment. And so we adjusted for that. Given those adjustments, the statewide average is about 5 hours per resident day of direct care. Now, the RNs are multiplied in that to do that wage adjustment. So it's probably actual direct care hours, more like 4 hours that we're currently providing on a statewide average.
And I do know that'll be a topic of much additional conversation. A quick follow-up, Senator Sharon?
Well, simply that this needs really close examination.
Yes.
Numbers can say all sorts of things. When you start using an acuity method, which I think is important a part of this, and you're trying to allocate your resources and you get to count it against a number. A lot of people who are not at that acute level then are left without much time because the resource goes to the acutely ill, which is needed. And when you think about what people are doing in a nursing facility, that care is directed toward the acutely ill, and the other person who's living there is left without much, a minimal amount of time, and on their own. And that's just an environment that encourages all sorts of deterioration. This is something that we will need to spend time talking about.
We will get much further behind these numbers as we roll forward. I know that there's some proposals out there that'll push us on that conversation and welcome it. Real quick, I know that Assistant Commissioner Lights has joined us. He has only a half hour. Before we let this crew go, though, I know Senator Hayden, yesterday you had said you wanted to follow up with an autism question. Are you prepared to do that?
I'm going to talk to him offline.
Okay. Good enough. Well, Ms. Bartolik, Ms. Wood, Mr. Held, thank you for coming to join us today. With that, Assistant Commissioner Lights, thank you for returning to front a few questions. Maybe I'll kick us off here quick if you're ready. Did you have any introductory comments or just?
Nope, not at all, Mr. Chair. Happy to be back.
Right in. glad to have you. I kind of look at the governor's budget proposal tracking document. It's the first document in people's budget books there. And the implementation of the optional MA expansions up to 138, maybe you could just give us a little bit of more detail about how populations are moving around, where they're coming from and where they're winding up and how they're getting coverage in these various new categories that would be implemented under the expansion. Is that?
I'm happy to do that, Mr. Chair. Scott Lights from the Department of Human Services, for the record. Under the optional MA expansion, what we would be doing would be moving single adult populations, childless adult populations, up to 138% of poverty with the 5% income disregard. And then expanding Medicaid coverage for parents between 100 and 138 of poverty and 19 and 20-year-olds between 100 and 138 of poverty. And it results in 87,000 additional people coming into the medical assistance program. Some of those are new individuals who previously were not in coverage. George Hoffman, when doing the forecast, really looked at the effect of the requirement that individuals have health insurance coverage in 1114 and estimated that we would have some new individuals coming in. And then there's individuals who, because this income level is currently covered by our Minnesota Care program, would be moving over from Minnesota Care. And so we estimate that of the 87,000 folks who would be moving, about 53,000 of those would be people who were previously on the Minnesota Care program and now would be moving into the Medicaid program. This is, again, 100 in that case, largely federally funded. And then the remainder would be folks who would be new to Minnesota, new to medical assistance, about another 34,000 or so. We could break that down by category if you'd like, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to go into whatever level of detail you'd like there.
And in the expansion to 138, that's just the Medicaid populations, but then there was also the maintenance of effort that's part of and kind of integrally tied to the expansion in the way I always view it. Plus the streamlined eligibility and the rolling enrollment effects. And I was hoping to dive into some more of the interchanges between all of these intersecting.
Sure. I'm happy to do that, Mr. Chair. So let me just take those two categories. So what I just explained to you there was really the movement that occurs as a result of the optional expansion for medical assistance up to 138 of poverty, which is the governor's proposing to do. And so we have interactions there of new folks coming in and then folks shifting over from Minnesota Care. There's a second category, which is really what I started off with yesterday to talk about, which is streamlining of eligibility, moving from 6-month to 12-month renewal periods, presumptive eligibility at hospitals, and so forth. The costs there are really solely medical assistance costs, and that's because these are individuals who are currently eligible for our medical assistance program. We wouldn't be changing any bring anything new. This is just streamlining for medical assistance those who are already eligible. So that's a pure medical assistance effect on that one, and that's why you have some costs associated with that one. Most of the enrollment, there's about 63,000. We estimate about an overall impact of close to 64,000 individuals under the streamlining coming into the program. Most of that is due to the eligibility and renewal, the enrollment and renewal process changes. That would be the 12-month rolling out, 12-month eligibility, for instance. The third category that we have is really the maintenance of effort category. And so this is the requirement that we continue to cover children up to 275% of poverty on the medical assistance program. And there are offsetting effects that occur on this one. We have an increase in medical assistance of about 107,000 children coming into medical assistance as a result of that change. About 60,000 of those people are individuals who are kids who are previously enrolled in our Minnesota Care program, because Minnesota Care currently goes up to 275 of poverty. We'll be moving those children from Minnesota Care into medical assistance. And then about 47,000 people, children, are new enrollees, again, the effect of the requirement that individuals have health insurance coverage, as well as the effect of the expansion overall brings out about another 47,000 into coverage.
Okay. Any further questions on that, those issues? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Leitz. See a lot of movement in the Healthcare Access Fund. Big picture, where's the Healthcare Access Fund now, and where do we end up, say, 2014, 2015? Give me some number that is accessible to you.
Mr. Leitz. Chair, Senator Benson, if you'll give me just a moment. I do have that with me. And Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, you're right. There is some movement in of healthcare access fund dollars and general fund dollars because of the interactions that occur where people are moving from Minnesota Care into medical assistance, which is general fund funded as opposed to access fund funded, and some shifting of dollars that occur as a result of those changes where the dollars kind of follow the individuals into the coverage programs. I'm looking at the Healthcare Access Fund balance sheet, which I think was what you were – is that the question you're asking, Senator Benson?
Yes. Okay. If it's in my packet, guide me to it.
Okay. I don't know that this is actually in your packet. I'm not sure that that's something that members probably have. So
don't believe it is in our packets just yet. Maybe the department can distribute that.
We'd be happy to. It's afterwards. A MMB document. I just had it as a background document for purposes, but we'd be happy to get copies to the members on it. And it's I'm not an expert on Healthcare Access Fund balance sheets. It's not our purview necessarily at the department, but I will do my best to try to let you know what I can tell from the balances. There is in the Healthcare Access Fund, starting in fiscal 14, there's a net projected balance on the bottom line after the transfers and movements that were referred to in the governor's budget of around $201,000 and $318,000. And then when we get to the out years, the balance grows for fiscals 16 and 17. And this is after, again, after the reserving of the $300 million. So what can I, if I will, I'm just going to stop and back up just a second here. You'll recall in the governor's budget, what we did is because we don't know what the result of the BHP discussion with CMS is, the basic health plan discussion with CMS is going to be, we basically have a placeholder there contingent on those discussions where we reserved $300 million to kind of set aside so as a contingency for, you know, whatever happens on those discussions if we need to add to the funding and so forth. And so after we account for that $300 million set aside, that takes most of the money that would otherwise have sat on the bottom line of the Healthcare Access Fund. And so you have fairly low numbers, the $200,000 and the $300,000 figures. That's largely because of that contingency fund that we set aside. In the out years, when you go to 16 and 17, the balance on the fund grows to $381 million in 16 and about close to $800 million by fiscal 17.
But would you say that it's the general intent of the shifts between the general fund and the Healthcare Access Fund that those populations who were historically supported by the Healthcare Access Fund by virtue of their participation in Minnesota Care, the general attempt was when Minnesota Care populations, because of the effects of the changes that we're making, when those populations move into Medicaid, you're moving Healthcare Access Fund dollars to support the state expenditures somewhat commensurate with with the movement of the populations. That's what you were trying to get at? Is that?
Mr. Chair, that's very well stated. These are traditionally populations that were covered for through the Access Fund because we were providing access to them. The movement of the dollars is really to follow them in the coverage they're receiving. That's very well stated.
Okay, and it's understood.
Much the intent.
We're, you know, these are tough to track perfectly all of the shifts, but that's why I wanted to dig behind it a little bit and try to get some general principles. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner Lynch. So I just need to try to get this, to wrap my head around it. If we do the BHP, and I know that there is, you know, all this ongoing discussion with CMS about that, but if that happens, I mean, the Healthcare Access Fund is spending, it's a 50% match, right, today. For folks that are on Minnesota Care, is that right? And so if we get what we want from the BHP, would it still be a 50% or would there be a greater portion from the federal government than what we're getting today for this population?
But, you know,
Or is that just
it depends on what negotiate with the feds. And, you know, an update on that from this morning, we got a letter from our congressional colleagues, and it had, again, just like similar to the legislative letter that we sent to Commissioner Sebelius, 9 of our 10 federal colleagues sent a similar letter, really pushing to try to get the feds to break this. So exactly the level of FFP that we could expect in a BHP is unknown today, and that's what we're trying to break down and get behind. The BHP in the Affordable Care Act says that the general framework of it, as specified in the law, is that for populations up to 200% of federal poverty, and I'm going to assume at this point that we're going to do the expansion to 138. So the BHP, if you think about it, for the population between 138 and 200% of federal poverty level, what the Affordable Care Act calls for is 95% of the premium supports and cost-sharing subsidies that would have otherwise flowed to those individuals would be made available to the state to build a single program, something that looks something like Minnesota Care, to support this population. And so we've asked Gruber and Gorman, who have done the really in-depth analysis, to try to price out what it would cost. And we did it with several variables, you know, bronze level supports in terms of premiums and cost shares, Medicaid payment rates, whether we increase those a little bit to better compensate providers, what we do with additional benefits that would have to be done at 100% state dollars. You know, all of these are variables, and each of them are played with separately in the projections that we have. So we're getting a pretty good sense of what we could do, but it's all dependent on what we get from the feds. We're missing guidance on exactly what the 95% would look like. And the biggest piece is whether it's risk adjusted, and if so, how? You know, and it makes a difference. These lower income populations are sicker and more expensive, and that's just a demographic and undeniable fact. And so if you calculate that 95% basically on the population that goes through the exchange and buys premiums, that population above 200%, it's a very different look than if you calculate it on the cost experiences and the supports that would have happened if you'd done it just with this population. So is it risk-adjusted, and how is it risk-adjusted? And there's something greater than a 15% differential between those. And so without that guidance, we can't put the numbers on our spreadsheets. We can't put the policy on our books. We can't get this the BHP built. And so that's what we're pushing for. We need the clarity and the guidance from the feds to make good decisions here in Minnesota. And I think we're experiencing really good bipartisan support in pushing the feds to quickly resolve those issues so that we can make these discussions. I mean, these determinations, Senator Lights, Commissioner Lights, if you have more to add, that's my take. I've been working on this hard too.
Mr. Chair, you certainly have, and know this as well as anyone. The only thing I would just add to your point on the risk adjustment piece of this and why it's so important for us to get resolution on things like what the rules and guidance are going to be on this, if the amount that we receive is fully risk-adjusted, we think it's 95% of what the subsidy is going to be. If it's not risk-adjusted at all, it's about 67% of what the subsidies would otherwise be because of the differences in the health and sickness of the population. So just to your point, yes, it's an important aspect.
Good. And, Mr. Chair, I think that that was important. I think that that was the part that kind of gets missed around here. When you hear the 95%, you don't know all that. It looks apples to apples with this population. So I think that it became this kind of no-brainer conversation about the BHP, and so I think it's helpful when you and Commissioner Lentz talk about this in that context, because then I think that we can start to figure out kind of what we're going to be on the hook for.
Yeah.
But at first blush, right, it was kind of what's the big deal, and I think now we kind of, at least I have a better understanding of the complexity of what you're having to deal with and why it is so important that we get that guidance from CMS before we make our decision. So I think that's helpful. Thank you, sir.
Good. I think so too. And hopefully people are tracking. It's very difficult. I mean, there's a lot of just combining of the concepts of the exchange and the concepts of BHP and the concepts of, you know, the market rules, and all these things blur when you get beyond this room very far at all, and it's hard to keep everything straight, but at least being speaking with clarity in here is important. Other questions for Commissioner Lights? I have a couple. You know, one, you know, a big piece of the money that was redirected within the HHS budget came from the competitive bidding that was largely in the metro area here. And it was, you know, I think a really big success. And I'm wondering if the department has any designs on moving that statewide, or are you expanding that experience? Is that possible? Is it something that you're interested in doing?
Mr. Chair, if it's fine, I would just talk a little bit about kind of what we've done with our managed care contracting processes over the course of the past couple of years. I think that was a very high area of focus for the governor and for Commissioner Jessen when they took office, was to really take a look at and modernize the way that we're doing our contracting with managed care plans. And the first thing that we did in the first year of the governor's term was to really do that competitive bid in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, where we were traditionally our rate setters in our managed care process. We kind of went to more of a market-based solution there, and really did a competitive bid and said, "You tell us what you would charge to care for our clients." And we got a very large savings out as a result of that. And it came not only did we get the savings, but we were able to actually move people into plans really successfully. We had a good continuity of care as a result of that, and the plans were actually really great about working with us around those changes. They competitively, went against each other, and we got some really good savings as a result of that. And then as part of the 2011 budget deal, we did place some constraints or some caps. The legislature passed some caps on how much capitation could grow into the future beyond the savings of what came from the competitive bid. And then this year during contract negotiations with the plans, we actually were able to hold below those statutory caps, which created some additional savings. That's what shows up in the governor's budget this year, some additional savings beyond the competitive bid savings and beyond the cap savings. I think moving forward, we know that there will be more people coming into our programs through the medical assistance program and the continuation, hopefully, of MinnesotaCare. And what we will be looking at then is how do we best make sure that the contracting that we do continue to do makes good use of taxpayer dollars and continues to drive that down. One of the reasons competitive bidding works so well in the Twin Cities metropolitan area is that there's a lot of bodies, frankly, in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. A lot of people live here, 60% of our population. And what one of the things we want to be cautious about, I think prudent about, is as we move into less populated areas of the state, making sure that, there is sufficient amounts of people to make it to make the bid competition attractive to plans. And so that's one of the things we're working through right now. I think if we were going to do it in rural Minnesota, we'd certainly want to do it in areas where it's more highly populated or to combine up larger amounts of counties to allow for that mass to have that occur. We haven't made any final decisions on that, but I think it's obviously something that we felt was successful the first time. We may wish to use it again into the future to try to get not only price savings, which I think was a focus of the first contract, but we also are really interested in working with the managed care organizations that do and county-based purchasing plans that do the work on behalf of our clients around payment reforms that they're doing with providers and maybe having more competition or more innovation in those areas as well. And that's something we'll want to try to drive out into the future as well. So I not a specific answer to your question, but something that we are definitely interested in looking at and are going to, kind of keep our eye on it as things move forward.
Another one, I saw there's a dental increase. I don't have it right in front of me in here, but there's a increase for dental rates. And what's the interaction between that and our critical access provider rates? Is that something? I couldn't really tease that out from the documents we have in front of us.
Mr. Chair and members, so we have kind of the rates that we pay for a dentist that operates in our for dental providers that operate in our programs. And then for certain dental providers, they're designated as critical access for a critical access dental program. And they get an additional rate bump for the services that they deliver because they're deemed to be sort of they do high volumes of our patients. As we stepped back and looked at the dental program, there's a couple things I'd like to mention in response to that. The first was that we hadn't increased the rates in our Medicaid dental program in 14 years, and costs for dentists have gone up over the course of the last 14 years. And so we felt it was important to make an adjustment in our rates to across the board, just bring up our base of rates that we pay for services provided to dental provided to dentists. As I mentioned in my testimony yesterday, we pay about 20% below what the national average is compared to when you compare Medicaid rates to commercial rates. We're below the rest of the country on that, and we've let that slip for a long period of time. And we do have some chronic dental access issues in Minnesota, and getting dentists to participate in our programs is challenging, not because it's just the economics for them don't add up very well. And we wanted to try to address that through this budget. We can't fully get there in 1 year, but we think this is a good start to get there. That is separate from the discussion around the critical access dental, where there's an add-on to the base rate that occurs for those dentists who are serving high levels of our clients. And I think, Mr. Chair, over the course of the next 6 months or so, that's a program that we want to take a look at to make sure that we're targeting the dollars in that program as effectively as we can. We've made changes to that program over time. I think it's become confusing for dentists to know, how do I get to be a critical access dentist? Who is a critical access dentist? What are the criteria that you're using? We want to make that a lot clearer for folks and make sure that we're doing our work around targeting those dollars in areas where there truly is where dentists are truly doing work that would otherwise just not get done. And so I think the interaction here is that the base comes up as a part of the governor's proposal. We think that's just an important first step. But then the next step is really to look at the critical access dental program and make sure that we're targeting that program in the right way and that the criteria around how you participate and who gets to get that designation is done correctly and clearly. So that'll be our next step. We may be back next year. We're not ready to, we weren't quite ready to bring something before you this year on that issue, but that might be one in the interim moving into next year we'll probably want to have some conversations with you about.
So 5% increase on dental rates is what's in the package, and then the critical access is it's an increment above the new base, and so
yes,
the critical access would also experience that bump. Okay.
Mr. Chair, one final thing on that. We increased that rate 5%, and it was done for both our fee-for-service program as well as
right.
In PMAP just because of the critical kind of shortages we have in that area.
Any other questions for Commissioner Lights? Seeing none, Scott, thank you for coming back today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, we will move on to Erin Sullivan Sutton and ask her first to help members understand how you're going to approach your presentation. Are we going to work through the MMB documents or the fast facts, and where are you going to start on them? Just so that we can follow you.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members, I'm going to work primarily from the MMB document, although I will reference the fast facts.
Yep. And state your name for the record and give us the page number on the MMB documents, and we'll all be able to work with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the department. And I am beginning on page 16 of the MMB document. I have four recommendations that I will be talking about, or eight recommendations I'll be talking about. Four of them are reductions, and four will be investment proposals. As you have seen, the governor has recommended some significant investments in the safety and healthy development of children. Most of them are in my area. I do want to mention two that you will hear from later by others. One is an increase in mental health services in the schools that Assistant Commissioner Hartford will talk about following me. And then Chief Financial Officer Chuck Johnson will also share with you some recommendations for increasing safety in family child care. The first item I want to talk about is Reform 2020, and it's a housing stability demonstration. This is a part of the Reform 2020 demonstration that you have heard about from the continuing care area. This proposal seeks to demonstrate that by providing housing stability services, we can help thousands while also saving money. This is contingent on the Medicaid waiver. We are targeting two primary groups. The first are people who receive general assistance who have a disability or of advanced age and are homeless, and also people who are in group residential housing and live in registered housing where services developed specifically as a part of the state plan to end homelessness. We know that lack of stable housing for our state's poorest adults result in higher health care costs and more serious medical conditions, and we believe that by providing housing stability services, we can help increase the stability of these individuals. And also one of the things that we have seen is that research involving similar target populations around the country has resulted in a 25% decrease in ER visits and hospital admissions and 41% lower overall Medicaid rates. Our estimates are that through this demonstration project, we will be able to serve approximately 3,000 individuals a month and estimated savings of $17 million over 5 years. So rather than paying for these services with state dollars, we believe that they'll be Medicaid eligible. Again, this will be contingent on waiver approval.
Right. I was going to make that point again. Members may recall this was part of the discussion, Reform 2020 is largely reliant on approval of federal waivers. And so these are contingent upon that approval, the dollars on the sheet here. So
that's correct.
Do you want to wait for questions?
You know, I think we have time to take questions as we go. Senator Sharon?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Commissioner. As a part of Reform 2020, there is looking at the long-range demographics and the need to change what we're doing now because we know we're going to have huge influx of seniors to care for long-term care. And part of that change, as I understand it, is that we're looking at increasing the requirements for entrance into the highest and most costly care. You know, so instead of meeting three criteria, you have to meet five criteria in order to be in or stay in the highest care facilities. And then we are going to develop a system, a community, more of a community-based system to support those who don't meet that higher level of care and really readjust everything and build that system to serve people in appropriate levels of care to their needs. But in the transition, there's concern that people who have spent down their assets, maybe sold their homes, have changed their living situation, that they will be impacted by this in a way that changes their capacity to live in a facility. They're back in the community without the house that they had when they moved into the facility. Is the designation of this housing stability service demonstration, was this developed in consideration in combination with that change, or is this serving a different population? Because I'm concerned that that we have this, but I'm also concerned, I'm not certain that that this was designed thinking about the potential impact of that other change in Reform 2020.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, this was designed as one component of the larger reform effort, recognizing that the use of medical assistance to provide supports to people living in the community, not just housing them, but providing community supports, stability services, tenancy services, doing those sorts of things can help keep people out of higher cost care. So it's just one small component of that larger project that you heard about.
Senator Lori, yes, Sharon. I understand that. I think your answer to me is this is a program that's designed to preempt the movement to a higher level of care and does not respond to my concern about another proposal. And I think we need to pay attention to what people have sold their assets. They've gotten rid of their assets, and they're going to be moved out of facilities that house them into community-based services without the social support system, including housing, to surround them. So they may need this. It may be another population that needs housing support.
Senator Sharon, I think that's an accurate description.
And if I could just back you up for my own purposes, and maybe I missed something, but I heard you, your Children and Family Services, and you were talking a lot about the effect on kids. When I read the fast facts sheets, it's all about adults in the way I read the fast facts sheets. Can you just help me reconcile those? I'm sure there is one, but I'm
sure. Mr. Chairman, this is primarily about children. This is one area within Child and Family Services where we have responsibility for the GRH program and general assistance, which is targeted for adults without children.
Okay, so when you say this is about children, you mean your function, of your function in your division is about children and certainly the families that the children live in. But
that's
this
correct.
Particular item is about GRH and adults without children.
That's correct,
okay.
Which is in our area as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I will move next to the next item, which is, in fact, about children. This is the governor's recommendation to increase access to quality care for children with high needs. As you know, almost half of Minnesota's children arrive for kindergarten not fully prepared for school. As you look at the recommendations here, I want to just also remind you that there are recommendations in the Department of Education's budget that are very complementary in terms of increasing resources for early childhood for the most at-risk children in our state. The proposal here would increase, would change the child care payment structure by simplifying the rate structure and moving from about 2,000 payment structures to a cluster basis, and would also increase the rates for some providers. We would also increase access to high-quality child care by reimbursing providers who achieve a 3-star parent aware rating, which is part of our quality improvement rating system for early childhood programs in Minnesota, up to 15% higher, and providers who achieve a 4-star rating, we would reimburse them up to 20% higher than the maximum rates in the program. We also have a part of this proposal to increase, to encourage teen parents to complete their education, and this would allow teen parents headed, families headed by parents under 21 years of age to have automatic access to child care. Currently, if the parents are not eligible for MFIP, teen parents may be put on the basic sliding fee, and they're not automatically eligible. So this recommendation would move child care for children of teen parents to a forecasted program, and so that we can assure that kids, in fact, are able to complete high school. We also have a couple of provisions in here that are intended to address situations where children's care is abruptly terminated or changed because of either the actions of the parent or actions by the part of the provider. And we really wanted to look at policies to make sure that we're not doing things to create further trauma and instability for children where we can avoid doing so. So we have two provisions here. One would be to increase continuity of care by allowing a 30-day reinstatement period for families served by the basic sliding fee program. And that just means that parents have a longer time to get the necessary paperwork in, and we will not terminate child care assistance abruptly. The other change is strengthening the program integrity by aligning disqualification periods and withholding authorizations or payments for up to 3 months so that a provider can make changes or corrections that they may need to make, and we would not abrupt the care of children. If there's not any questions there, I will go to the next item, which is entitled.
And let me just help members. Some of us are tracking remember the FF29, you're going to do the North Star?
Yes.
Next, FF29 in the yellow document. I noticed some members were tracking and some weren't, and I promised Senator Benson I'd give us little guideposts. So FF29.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. North Star Care for Children. This is a complex proposal. This is a proposal that would combine what are now 3 separate programs for caring for children in out-of-home care into one program. It is a program simplification, but also works to address the situation where we have significant disparities in the level of benefits that are available for caring for children who are in foster care on a temporary basis and those children who move to permanence, either through permanency with a transfer of legal custody to a relative or permanency through adoption. We have had the foster care program has had a built-in cost of living by law for a number of years. The relative custody assistance and the adoption assistance program have not had a cost of living adjustment. And so what we have seen over the years is an increasing disparity between the level of benefits. In fact, you received a report in 2002 where there was a recommendation that you look at consolidating the programs into one program at that time. We absolutely recognize the importance and need for foster care. Foster parents provide an invaluable resource for children who are in crisis. And yet we also know that because of our payment structure, we are creating barriers to permanency for a number of children who are not able to be adopted or move with relatives simply because the resources available to care for them is about half of what their caretakers would receive if they remain in foster care. This is particularly a problem when we're looking to find permanent adoptive families for older children and sibling groups. And so the recommendation that we have before you is based on a demonstration that we did under the 4E program a number of years ago, where we created a single benefit that followed children as they moved from foster care to permanency with relatives or adoption. And under that 4E waiver, what we did in fact see is that we saw more children being adopted, particularly children of color, African-American and American Indian children. Now, what I will also tell you is that that waiver, the benefit level remained at the foster care level. So that was something that this proposal does not do. But I think one of the things that we saw through that waiver process and the evaluation is simply having the stability of benefit available was important to people, and not having to face a reduction in resources available to care for children. In an ideal world, we would accomplish this by raising every benefit to the foster care level. That's simply too costly to do. Raising everything up to the highest level would require about a $47 million investment in the state years, in the out years. It's very costly. And so we're looking at this as a one-time mid-course correction. The proposal that you will see would not impact any child currently in our foster care system. So we would look to create a new program starting for children entering care on or after January 1st of 2015, so that we would not reduce the level of resources to foster parents who are currently providing care, and that we have a time to adjust to the change. The proposal that we're recommending also would have a built-in cost of living across the board, so that would be into the program. So what you will see when you have the bill before you is, as I said, making the changes into the future and also trying to reconcile some small reduction in benefit levels for some children. About 6% of the children would receive a reduction into the future. Again, not new children. But then we would increase the benefits available for families who accept permanent responsibility either through transfer of custody or per adoption. So, for example, just to give you an illustration, the highest monthly rate available in the foster care program is over $2,200 a month. Under the proposal that you will see, is the highest available will be about $1,800 a month. So there's some adjustment for the highest in care, but again, we're looking at a one-time kind of mid-course correction, and then we'll see those levels increase over time. And again, we'll be seeing some reduction in that high end of foster care, but an increase for relative care and permanency.
Senator Hayden had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Sullivan Sutton. So we've kind of talked about this over the years. So I guess the question would be, from an evaluation perspective, one of the concerns about this, not putting, you know, it's sounds too costly to put the $47 million in to get them equal, but by reducing the higher end of the foster care subsidy and using that money to raise the permanency subsidy, that there was some concern that the dollars, the difference might make foster care parents not take those high-need children, and that might be or at least that was the conversation, is that the rate, the level that the subsidy was at for the highest need children was there for a reason. And if we reduce that, will we then see folks maybe not take those children because they don't feel like they have the appropriate amount of resources to take care of them?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, I think that is a question that has been raised by some. We don't know that yet at this point. We also want to make sure that kids in foster care, particularly special needs foster care, have access to mental health treatment and other services that they need. The resources that are provided in the foster care program are not dollars that are used to purchase health care or mental health care. So those are benefits that would be available to the children. But the issue that you raise is certainly an issue that we would want to watch very, very closely. because we do not want to discourage people from coming forward to caring for foster children. In fact, we want to encourage foster parents to adopt the children in our care. And I think that's one of the difficult things about this proposal is that balancing act and trying to be responsible moving forward, recognizing that every year that goes by, we have more and more of a problem and disparity. And in some fashion, our feeling is very strongly is that we need to make some correction here. And we don't know what the impact will be. Again, that's part of the reason that we're recommending that implementation be in 2015. So there's time for the state to prepare. You will recall when you all passed the Minnesota Care many years ago, there was, I think that was the program, that there was a date into the future so that people could be prepared and ready for the transition.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me. I think that I mean, my concern is obviously I want the permanency rates to go up, so I do think that it has a huge impact on, you know, making sure that all kids get an opportunity to have a permanent family. But I am really, really concerned that this is a kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul kind of proposition, and that we should really think deeply as we start to go through this at really rising all boats in this instance and not – unless we somehow really feel like the highest end of the subsidy is egregious and that is more than what parents need or foster parents need to take care of these children. But by lowering that rate just to raise the other rate, I'm not sure that is what we would want to do. I'm very concerned about those children, and I'm very concerned that we will now start to pit those two communities against each other. And we spent a lot of time, and I know, Commissioner, you spent a lot of time thinking about this, but I really do think that our mid-course adjustment should be to add more money to the fund as a whole and not necessarily reduce one to raise the other.
Senator Hayden, I share your concerns in that regard. I expressed that yesterday when we had a brief conversation about this. You know, the fact that it would cost $47 million to bring the adoptive payments up, and there's only $2.4 million invested here. I mean, I think that's a pretty clear indication that we're bringing the foster care down quite a bit to subsidize the adoptive side of the house. And that's, it's all premised on an assumption that the primary barrier to permanence in Minnesota is financial. And, financial disincentives certainly do work as a disincentive. But I think there's other factors at play as well. And I would really want to dig deep into the science behind this and understand better what we're trying to accomplish and understand what the results are going to be. So I think I heard you say on the high end of foster care, it goes from about $2,200 a month to $1,800 a month, something in that ballpark. I see that there's something on the order of 7,700 children in family foster care during a given year. How many of those are at the high end? And do the reductions go beyond the high end in the foster care system into the middle end and lower end of the foster care payment rates, or are we trying to maintain stability within the foster care rates all the way up to the high end, but then reducing those, just so that we can have a better understanding of exactly what this proposal is, because it's not
sure,
entirely
Mr.
clear.
Mr. Chairman and members, and you will see, get more detail, including charts, when you actually hear a bill on this. So a couple of things I want to mention. One is it's about, our estimate is that there would be a reduction for about, again, not current children, but presumably 6% of the foster care population into the future. Two other things I want to mention is that, and that's at the high end. There would also be a recommendation in the proposal that that you will see will be that the new program would have basic rates based on three age categories, one being 0 to 5, second being 6 to 12-year-olds, the third being 13 to 20-year-olds. And what you would see is a slight decrease in the basic rate for 0 to 5-year-olds, and a slight decrease, I think, for 11-year-olds, if I recall correctly, or 12-year-olds. But for the rest, it would be a slight increase across the board. I would also mention that the proposal that we are looking at has two other components I want to make sure I bring to your attention. One is that the new benefit for permanency would be available for children over the over 5 years of age. And the reason for that is the state and counties and agencies are pretty successful getting little kids adopted at the current subsidy rate. And again, because of cost issues, frankly, the proposal would have the higher benefit available for kids over five, because it's really the kids from 6 to, you know, 18 that are most difficult to adopt. The other thing I would mention is currently there are actually relative custody assistance doesn't have a special needs component, but adoption assistance and foster care have two different assessment mechanisms for assessing the special needs of kids in care. One is in foster care, it's called the difficulty of care, and it's a complex process based on points depending on how many issues or challenges a child has. What is being proposed is the creation of a new universal assessment process that would be available for along the continuum of children in care, and it's based on what the care is that is needed for the child, and that's something that the department has been working with counties and providers for the past couple of years. We'll give you more information about that as well.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, maybe I'm not doing the 6% right, but I'm multiplying it by the 7,700 children who were in family foster care sometime during 2011. And certainly many of them were, are multi-year, and so maybe it's not a perfect analogy, but as we move forward and do this, I'm looking at something in the ballpark of 450 kids, over time as we reach a stable place. And that's a lot of kids with a lot less resources for families stepping up, trying to provide care in incredibly difficult situations. It's something that we will pay very close attention to. So look forward to seeing more on the proposal as we move forward.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to, if you wanted any other questions on the finances, John Sellen is here and could respond to any questions. Who's been our fiscal person on this?
Senator Sharon?
Mine is simply a furthering of this discussion. We also have had, when we're talking about, anytime we talk about rebasing, we're trying to stay within a certain budgetary process. There are those, this is for hospital rebasing or nursing home rebasing, if we give some less in order to achieve some benefits for those that have less. There is this dynamic, but there is the other dynamic too, the consequence of not creating some relief for the other parts of the system. And I want to just hope that as these proposals come forward, you'll talk more. We've been trying to get relative care some support. They really are an outlier in the system. And especially when it's a grandparent or a working family member willing to take in a person, and that's very, very much a positive for a child to be in a family with a family member that they already know. But our supports to them are really inadequate. Elders are having to pay down their dollars that they have to support their future health care costs or their future living costs in retirement. In order to do that, they can't afford to do it. So I really applaud the effort to try to bring some money into those other systems. They need it. And as we do the increases, that disparity grows, just like it does in the rebate in the issues around the hospitals and the nursing homes. And it does deserve some attention and some adjustment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I will move on then to rebuilding an effective MFIT program, and that is on the Fast Facts, page 31. As you know, the Minnesota Family Investment Program has been Minnesota's longstanding jobs program for people who are in poverty, who have lost lost employment or unable to find employment. Over the course of the NFIP program was developed through an extensive field trial demonstration in the late 80s, and over time there have been significant changes to that program, and it has become very complicated. And we are proposing a number of structural changes that will lay a foundation for continuing to improve that program and to focus on really looking at performance outcomes and our ability to help people get jobs. I'm going to talk to you about three proposals that the governor is recommending here. One is the possibility of a federal waiver. Secondly is simplifying the county administration of the program. And third, our collaborative work with the Department of Health to more effectively serve teen parents, which is a significant population on this program. The complexities of the Minnesota Family Investment Program make it very expensive to administer. Employment counselors throughout the state tell us that they spend more than half of their time tending to paperwork and documentation requirements of NFIP. We are hoping through the work that we're proposing that they will have the ability to spend more time on providing direct services to individuals to help them find and obtain employment. We are hoping to pursue a federal waiver that would allow us to replace the federal process measure known as the work participation rate that currently governs the program to focus on an outcome measure that really focuses on people getting jobs, which we call the self-support index. The federal work participation measure counts the number of parents on assistance who are in one of 12 activities officially recognized as work-related for at least 20 or 30 hours a week, depending on the age of the youngest child. That work participation rate does not count parents who actually go to work. So just to give you an example of how complex our program has become, is we really have now MFIP is a series of programs. So we have the diversionary work program, which is available for people who, when they first come to assistance after leaving employment, that we vendor pay some services, and that's a four-month program. It doesn't count to the individual's 60-month time limit. We don't count those people in our work participation rates, but we try to help them get jobs very quickly. Then we have the core MFIP program, which is very focused on the work participation rate. And then we have a work benefit program that provides $25 a month for families who actually get jobs. Yep. And part of the reason that was created was we wanted to count them in our work participation rate. So the way to do that was to give them a benefit. Mm-hmm. And that's just illustrative of how complex it has become. So we're hopeful that we can reinvigorate our program and focus on employment outcomes through the assistance of a federal waiver that I mentioned. The governor's budget also proposes to include the strategic use of one-time funds to support the development of promising practices, including on building on some successful demonstrations to improve employment outcomes, particularly for African American and American Indian parents, replicating some of the successful work study projects that we've seen in Kentucky and California, as well as some early demonstrations that were done in some of our counties in Minnesota several years ago, and also providing for some successful models of paid work experience. We're looking to simplify the program as well. Counties spend more than twice as much time to administer the Minnesota Family Investment Program than they do the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, in part because depending on where a family is, they're opening a case and closing a case as they move from diversionary work. They may be opening an MFIP case, closing that case as they move to the work benefit program. So there's a lot of process requirements as a part of this. And as I mentioned, the work benefit program provides $25 a month for up to 2 years for parents who leave MFIP with a job. What the governor is proposing is rather than administration of that program, in fact, he recommends suspending that program, but instead we increase the income disregard as we calculate how much benefits people should receive who are working. So currently the disregard is at 40%. We propose raising that disregard to 50%, which in fact is the same disregard for people who are on unemployment insurance in Minnesota. So if you are on unemployment insurance and you're working part-time, unemployment will discount 50% of your earnings when they calculate how much your unemployment would be. And what we find is that many of the families who come to MFIP come because they've recently lost a job. The only difference is their circumstances are such that they are not eligible for unemployment insurance. So what we're proposing is that we provide the same disregard for individuals in this program as is available in the unemployment insurance program. What I will also mention with that is currently people exit the program at 115% of poverty. When MFIP was first created in the early field trials, the exit level was at 140% of poverty. By increasing the disregard here to 50%, we would in fact have an exit level at about 143% of poverty. And what it means in terms of dollars is about $38 rather than the $25. So it's not a lot, but it would add simplification to the program and get a little bit more money into the hands of families. And it really would work to reward those who are working, because we also have people who are working on the MFIP program as well as the work benefit program. We think that we would reach about 16,000 children in about 7,400 families doing that. You will also see some proposals in the department's policy bill that don't cost any money but also will provide some administrative relief to counties in terms of trying to simplify the program. The other area I want to talk about briefly is the focus here on teen parents. Three-quarters.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Sullivan Sutton. Going back to rebuilding an effective MFIP program, two things. I understand that suspending the work benefit program, has that been settled at the federal level? Because there was some controversy as to whether that could be done through, I can't remember if it was an executive order or a change in rulemaking, but statute that specifically created the TANF program doesn't allow that to be disregarded. So is that the federal waiver you're talking about, or are we just moving forward? I'd like some explanation, please.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, the work benefit program is actually a Minnesota-created program.
I misspoke. I meant the documentation that you're required to do for TANF. I was looking at the wrong word here, where you have to track the paperwork of someone to see if they're making progress towards work or sufficient education or certain volunteer activities. You said there was a lot of paperwork at the county level for that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, that is correct. This past fall, the Obama administration, the Department of Health and Human Services, indicated interest in receiving waiver requests in the TANF program from states. That became very controversial. We had some conversations with Washington early on, and as well as people within Minnesota, in terms of if there is that opportunity, could we recommend a waiver request that would get us out from those process requirements and instead focus on work? Now, one of the things that there was some discussion in the political arena about whether or not someone in Congress might introduce legislation that would prevent the administration from allowing for waivers. That has not occurred yet. And so we believe, and the administration believes, that they do have the ability to grant waivers. We have not submitted anything yet. In fact, you will see in the bill that's before you to come is that we would request the legislature's authority to seek a waiver and implement a waiver, because we want to be doing this hands in hands with the legislature so that we're fully informed and engaged as we move forward.
And
Senator Benson.
Quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see an increase in FTEs for this program. Are we going to see savings at the county level with the reduction in paperwork and the streamlining that you're looking at?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, very good question. We think so. The thing that we have a hard time quantifying exactly where those dollars are, and so you don't see that booked here, but we can talk to you more about that.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, one question that I had is I see the federal funds listed on the MMB sheet. Are those contingent upon that waiver? And if so, how much of them? So, I mean, it's $3.5 million in 14, $1.7 million of federal funds in 15.
Are those funds contingent upon granting of this waiver?
Mr. Chairman, they are not.
They are not. Those are not.
Those
so
are not.
What is the effect of approval or denial of the waiver? That is, that's not, that doesn't have a financial?
We believe that the impact will have, there will be an impact locally in terms of the documentation required by employment counselors and county agencies. We don't see significant or any state savings that we can book, but we believe it will allow us, rather than focus on those process requirements, to focus on making sure and measuring whether or not people leave the program and get jobs.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Mr. Chairman, members, the next area I want to focus on in this program is teen parents, as I mentioned. Three-quarters of the teen parents on MFIP were on assistance when they were young children. We want to change that trajectory. We continue to see issues of intergenerational poverty, and we want to impact the lives of young mothers and the lives of their children. We have seen evidence shows that evidence-based home visiting programs show strong promise in the ability to help those young mothers graduate from high school and to improve the chances that their babies are healthy and meet important developmental milestones. So part of this recommendation is that we work with the Department of Health, and we want to solicit local partnerships so that public health home visiting services can be provided as the primary service offered to teen parents on MFIP. The proposal does not seek new money for
Ms.
service
Levinson,
funds.
Can you tell us which item you're on now?
I'm still on rebuilding and effective.
You're still on MFIP.
I'm still on
okay.
MFIP, the,
okay.
last component.
Sorry.
The proposal does not seek new service funds. In fact, our intent would be to use use one-time funds to help local partnerships and to provide training, and for those partners to get up and running in order to enroll teen parents on MFIP and home visiting services that are already available through home visiting funds that are provided to the Department of Health through the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families allocation that you have made. Our intent is to work with a handful of counties around the state and to really develop some learning opportunities and to form partnerships and practices and eventually to expand the model over time. What we have seen in the past is there's a disconnect between existing home visiting programs and teen parents. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that there's an engagement effort with teen parents to help them get on the program, to encourage teen parents to continue school, and to make sure that their babies have access to high-quality care. We believe that there are currently about 1,200 minor parents on MFIP and about 3,800 18- and 19-year-olds. And while these teen parents are a small fraction of the families on MFIP, we believe it's a very important population for us to focus on in order to try to have a more intergenerational impact. And we want to do what we can to increase the odds that young families don't have to face a lifetime of poverty. If we can help make sure teen parents finish school, prevent second pregnancies, et cetera. And we believe that the interaction between a nurse family practitioner will be a more constructive relationship than simply a job counselor at that point in their lives. So if there's not any further questions, I will go on to the next item, which is expanding the parent support outreach program. I think you have heard of this program before. This is a proven, effective early intervention program that is designed to reduce child abuse and neglect. This program was initiated as a pilot program in 2005. It's currently available in 38 counties. The recommendation here is to expand this program on a statewide basis, and the governor recommends the $4.5 million over the biennium. So this program is provided, it's a voluntary program that's provided to families who are reported for abuse and neglect, but on that given day may not be serious enough to be brought into the child abuse or the child protection system. The program provides an outreach to these families and offers voluntary services, which may be counseling, education, assistance in meeting basic needs, or assistance with chemical dependency or mental health services. There was a formal evaluation of the program, and what we found is that for those families who are at risk, For those families who receive services, they are, in fact, better off than similar families who don't receive services. There's a reduction in the report of future maltreatment reports, and, in fact, over 50% of the families who were in our original pilot reported that they were significantly better off for having had the benefit of the services.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you. Any statistics on the number of people that participated voluntarily versus those that chose not to?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Claussen, in the pilot, there was about a 50% take-up rate when an offer of services was made, which is pretty significant, especially for this population. And just to give you an example of the volume, so in Minnesota receives about 17,000 to 18,000 reports of maltreatment in a given year, and we receive about 38,000 reports are screened out, and it is that screened-out population that this program is targeting. Mm-hmm.
And then how long would that assistance last with the family?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it generally is a short-term assistance, but it can be helping that family get access to other services are available in the community.
Thank you.
All right, if there's not further questions on that, the next couple of proposals that I have are, in fact, reduction proposals. The first is eliminating the electronic benefit transaction fee. Currently, this proposal would eliminate the 4-cent fee paid to grocers who accept the electronic benefit transfer made under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Minnesota grocers who use their own point-of-sale terminals rather than those supplied by the state receive a 4-cent fee every time there's a SNAP EBT transaction. The fee originated in the early days when EBT was first being developed, when the payment card technology for SNAP was a very new concept. It was offered to encourage and supplement retailers to participate in offering an alternative payment method and to phase out the use of food stamp coupons. Current payment technology and consumer practice no longer require an incentive for retailers to participate in offering access to the SNAP EBT card transactions. Over the years, most states have stopped paying this fee. Minnesota is only one of a few states that continue to have it. The monthly amount the state pays to retailers has greatly increased with the significant growth in the SNAP program and with large retailers signing agreements with the state to receive these payments. We currently pay approximately $445,000 per year, and about 55% of that is a state match. And so the governor is recommending eliminating that.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Ms. Sullivan Sutton. I'm smiling because I think since I've been in the legislature, I've been looking at this fee and couldn't for the life of me figure out why we were paying grocers to take EBT cards so that they can make money when people go to buy their groceries. And I know that increasingly, I'm sure the Grocers Association will have some issues with this, but increasingly it was just an extra subsidy to give folks when they knew that people were going to come and use the card to buy their groceries. So I'm glad to see this in your budget book and hope to support it. And if there's anybody that you want to carry the bill, I may know someone that might want to do that. So. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman, Senator Hayden. The next item is a change to the adoption assistance forecast, and this is a recommendation for a reduction in the adoption assistance program, and this is simply a result of reduced caseload projections, primarily because of the reduction of the number of kids in foster care. The next item is the match supportive service expenditure, and here the governor is recommending that we seek a federal match on the Supplemental Nutrition Education, Employment, and Training Program, and that we seek the match based on expenditures under the Child Care Assistance Program and the Diversionary Work Program. You should know that we have claimed these revenues in the past. The state must get approval from the United States Department of Agriculture to be reimbursed for current eligible expenditures. In 2012 and 2013, we requested and received approval from the federal government to claim these revenues. The current state authority that allows us to claim $4.4 million expires at the end of this year, and this proposal would allow us to continue to receive the federal reimbursement that's already been approved, but we need the state authority in order to do so. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that's the end of my presentation.
All right. The adoption assistance forecast adjustment, is that one that on page 18 of the?
John said she just did it.
You just did it. Yeah, no, okay, I'm sorry. Any questions for Ms. Sullivan Sutton? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sullivan Sutton, the reduction of kids in foster care, was that a systemic change or demographic cause?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, we would say that there's a number of reasons for that, largely systemic in terms of reforming the front end of our child protection system, as well as focusing very much on reducing the length of stay kids are in foster care so that they're returned home safely with their families when that's possible. And if that's not possible, they're moved to permanent families as soon as they can be. And we have seen a significant reduction in the length of stay for children in out-of-home care.
Senator Benson, follow up.
There were some reforms that we did in the last 2 years. Are we seeing that bear fruit? Is that what's causing this, or is this a longer process?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, we have seen a reduction over time. However, the changes that have been implemented in the past year or two will further contribute to that.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Sullivan Sutton. That will end our agenda for the day, and we'll have a few minutes for a cup of coffee before session. And just as a heads up, we will finish reviewing the DHS budget proposals next Tuesday. We will take public testimony next Wednesday on all of the DHS proposals. And just a note to members, we will be in room 107 on Tuesday. Hello, we will be in room 107 on Tuesday. We stand adjourned. Thank you.